It is our last week of surveying, of tasting, trying to sample what the flavor of Matthew is. And if it's our last week in Matthew, then we should probably be at the end of Matthew, and that would be a really good guess. You're absolutely right. Matthew 28 is where we're going to be today. If you've been around church in any shape or form, in any kind of way, you probably heard this passage at some point. It's frequently called the Great Commission. It only shows up in Matthew's Gospel. It's the end of Matthew's Gospel, and so let's look at it. Matthew 28, starting in verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." First, let's just make a very surface level observation about all this. Jesus is back. Jesus is alive. This is startling because we saw him die. We heard Matthew tell us that this man died. But now, here he stands. Or maybe better yet, maybe more accurately, there he stood. Because we don't physically see Jesus standing here right now, do we? There he stood. Matthew told us that there he stood on a mountain. But we don't see him physically in this room right now, unless he's like hiding backstage behind a curtain or something. I don't physically see Jesus in this room. Matthew is saying that they did. They physically saw and heard and like touched Jesus. Jesus back. Jesus alive. It's something none of us have ever seen before. A man resurrected on the other side of death. Like he's the human being now that is immune from death. I've never seen this before in my life. Never seen this before. And Jesus is telling them, he told them on this mountain, he says, that now all authority, verse 18, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him. All authority, he is actively ruling as king. He was right. All of their suspicions were correct. All authority, all power, all command has been given to him. That's the language that the ancient world gave to conquerors. That's the language that the modern world gives to like prime ministers and presidents and that sort of thing. He's saying, you guys were all right. You guys were all right. I am the Messiah. I am the anointed. I am the one you've been waiting for, the Christ. And I'm not just king of some things. I'm not just king in Rome. I'm not just king in the world. I'm actually king of everything. I'm king of everything. And that's, can we just say for just a second, that's the way crazy people talk. Like, if I'm on the 16th, if I go today to the 16th Street Mall, or I go up to Boulder to Pearl Street, and someone walks up to me and says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, and that they are king of everything, I might buy them a burger. You know what I mean? I might buy them a burger and give them a couple of bucks or something, and I'm almost certainly going to laugh later and feel a little bad that, you know, a poor guy, I hope he gets his life together or something, but I'm not going to take that guy seriously. I guess the difference between the guy on Pearl Street or the guy on the 16th Street Mall and Jesus is that the reason why this was written down is that Matthew and the disciples had seen this guy come back from the dead. I guess that's the difference. Like, if you see a guy defeat death, you take this guy a little seriously. Oh my word, you're saying that you're the king of everything? Well, all right then. That's if you want a definition for what the church is, that's all the church is. The church is the group of people throughout the centuries who take Jesus seriously on this point. That he really is king of, like, the universe. King of quantum physics. He's the king of string theory. He's the king of everything. Jesus said, actually, you can throw slide one up, Bob. We actually heard Jesus predict this a few weeks ago. Back in Matthew 16, he said, "Truly, I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Jesus, here at the end of Matthew, is saying, it's arrived. It's arrived. All authority has now been given to me. I am king of everything. When he talked back there in Matthew 16, about being the Son of Man. What a mysterious title to give to yourself. The Son of Man. And when he talks about all authority right here in Matthew 28, he's actually tapping into the ancient scroll of Daniel. I know, scary stuff. Daniel. You can throw the next slide up, Bob. In Daniel, the scroll of Daniel says, it's psychedelic, it's apocalyptic, it's mysterious. We're going to be talking about apocalyptic stuff for the next 12 weeks. Don't worry, you're going to get your fill. Daniel is an apocalypse. It's this unveiling of heavenly realities. And Daniel says in Daniel 7, verse 13 and 14, he says, "In my vision," it's a strange, psychedelic, kind of like a weird trip that Daniel's on. "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days," God, "and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion, his kingdom, his authority, his government, his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed." And so Daniel, slide two, Bob, I'm sorry. Slide two is that bit of Daniel. Daniel is envisioning a day when evil and suffering and atrocities and terrible headlines would finally, once and for all, be defeated. Right before this bit, in Daniel 7, in Daniel's vision, there's been a terrifying parade. You guys know Thanksgiving parade with giant Snoopies and stuff like that. Most of the time we're familiar with pleasant parades. Daniel, if you mark it, it's worth reading. It's really interesting. Daniel 7 has been showing up to this point a terrifying, nightmarish kind of parade. Beast after beast has been coming out of the sea, out of the source of chaos, and every one of them has been more horrible and ugly and monstrous than the last. They're representative of kind of like world order, like different ways of ruling the world. And so like a beast rises up and takes the place of another beast. The warlord gets overthrown by a tyrant. The oppressive monarchy gets replaced by an oppressive republic. You know, it's just one monster after the next monster until finally something new arrives. In Daniel 7:13, something new arrives. The nightmarish parade ends. The endless march of evil through history finally comes to an end with a powerful figure, a human-looking figure, not an animal, not a beast, one like the Son of Man, one like a Son of Man, at least human-looking. For centuries, the Jewish people thought about this scroll. They thought about this vision. They prayed through this vision. They watched history. It's just evil after evil after evil throughout history. And they were looking and they were praying and they were saying, at some point, something new is going to arrive. It will be a kingdom, a dominion, an empire, a world order, a reality that is different than anything else. It will not be monstrous. It will not be just more beast after more beast. No. The beasts will vanish. They will be defeated, and a new reality will arrive. Something human. Something humane. And here, at the end of Matthew, that's what Matthew is saying has happened in Matthew 28. He's saying it has arrived. It has finally arrived. All authority has been given to the Son of Man. The monsters are defeated. A new reality, a new creation, a new way of living in this world. It's dawning. A new sun is rising. I have defeated death, is what Jesus is saying, and I am king of everything. And so that's all well and good. That's all well and good to look at the scroll of Daniel and to read something in Matthew 28. That's all fine and dandy. But I guess the haunting question for all of us that I kind of thought as a kid, I was thinking about Bryce and Kyle, and third or fourth grade is probably when I started thinking this question, why can't I see Jesus as king? Everybody's singing to him on Sundays. I can't quite see him. Anyone else? I know we're not supposed to call out, like, the invisible elephant in the room, or the invisible Jesus in the room, but, why is it, this seems strange. It seems really, really strange. Why can't I look at the headlines, and I can't quite see the defeat of evil in the headlines. If Jesus has been given all authority, if Jesus is king, if Matthew's serious, why does it look like this? Did he get promoted a little quickly from carpenter to king or something? You know, he's having trouble managing. I don't know. My point is, come November, when November comes, and then when January comes, it's going to be fairly obvious. It's going to be fairly certain who is receiving power and authority in the United States. Pick your poison. I don't know. What's going to happen? Good grief. But everyone is going to be able to see, everyone's going to be able to look and be fairly certain as to who the next president is, who has received all power and authority. Back in the ancient world, you could be pretty sure if you looked around, it was the same thing. You could look around and you could be fairly certain who had authority, who was on the throne, who had conquered the world. Whether it was Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or Caesar Augustus, just a quick glance at the town square, at like the statues that are standing around in your village, or the face that's on the coin in your pocket, or a glance at the armies that are patrolling the region or on your streets, or the crucified rebels who were trying to, you know, lead a rebellion, the crucified friends and rebels outside of your village, you could be fairly certain who ruled the world if you looked around. You could be certain who had all authority. If Jesus has all authority right now, if he has all power, why can't we see his rule and reign a little bit more clearly? Why does it feel like he's hiding backstage behind a curtain somewhere? I know only fourth grade Brett is the one who asks that question. Now, adults are too scared to kind of ask that question. Fourth grade Brett was too scared to ask that question. Why can't we see Jesus himself? What's going on? Why is the universe, the world set up in this way? Why does he always seem to be hiding behind a curtain backstage? He doesn't seem to make his power and his authority and his presence known like any king in history, like any president or prime minister in history. What kind of king is Jesus? I guess is the question. How does he conquer? How does he rule? How does he spread his kingdom? Based on the end of Matthew, we might answer those questions with just one word. How does he conquer? How does he rule? How does he spread his kingdom? I think the word would be gently. Gently. It's unlike anything we've ever known in human history. He spreads his kingdom. He rules his kingdom. He conquers gently. Every other prime minister or king or president eventually has to conquer with brutality, has to conquer with violence, killing those who disagree, crucifying the rebels outside of the city. Just look at you think this doesn't happen in the United States, but just look at our election cycle. Most political ads are 30-second crucifixions. Really, they're brutal. They're brutal. We're so used to a world where people conquer by brutality that it's hard to imagine a world where anything different. But the Son of Man is different. The Son of Man is different. The Son of Man doesn't conquer by brutality. The Son of Man conquers by baptism. By baptism. Jesus is not, he's not sending out his disciples to kill those who disagree with him. Okay, I'm king, I've got authority, now you need to go kill anybody who disagrees with me. No, he sends them out to teach. To make disciples, to baptize people, plunge them into a new kind of reality. Not to force people into his kingdom, but to love people into his kingdom. Not to show someone a cross and say, look, that's going to happen to you if you disobey. No, but to show them a cross and say, our King, our God has endured this because none of us obey. None of us obey, and so somebody has taken it. God still loves us endlessly. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit love us. Go make disciples and plunge them into, baptize them into, dunk them into this way of living, into this new reality. Jesus tells his disciples to go and conquer the nations. Go conquer the nations. Go make disciples of all the nations, teaching them everything that I've commanded you to do. Next slide, slide 3. And I think chief among them, let's just get a refresher on what Matthew, some of the heart of what Matthew has been talking about. What has Jesus been teaching in the Gospel of Matthew? You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven, that you may be children of God. Because God causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even tax collectors doing that? And if you greet your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your Father, or as your Heavenly Father is perfect. Be like the God who loves everyone. Love your enemies. I think the reason why we have trouble seeing the kingdom and Jesus' rule and reign is Jesus is a king. Unlike any king, Jesus is a king who conquers gently. God's conquering is a gentle conquering. Next slide. It looks like nonviolence. It looks like loving your enemies. It looks like doing good to all, sun rising on all, rains for crops on all. It looks like maybe the hardest thing for all of us to swallow. It looks like patience. It looks like patience. Jesus rules the world. He has all authority in the world, and he's just more loving and more patient and more gentle than any one of us want him to be. Than any one of us want. I think that's why God feels hidden a lot of times. Why Jesus feels like he's hiding behind a curtain backstage somewhere. Why he doesn't just overwhelm this world with knowledge of his presence. Why he doesn't just crucify everybody who disagrees with him. Why he doesn't just force everybody to walk the narrow road of love. Because Jesus isn't that kind of king. God isn't that kind of God. The only true God isn't that kind of God. Jesus doesn't become just one more beast overthrowing the latest, biggest, baddest beast. No, he doesn't become a monster in conquering the nations. Jesus doesn't. He isn't showing up and saying, okay, now that I finally got that cross business out of the way, now that I finally got all that suffering out of the way, now that I got all that patience out of the way, now I'm going to conquer by brutality. I'm going to conquer the world by force. No. He's going to conquer by baptism. He's go. Teach people the way of love. Teach. Make students of the narrow road. The church is the group of people throughout the centuries who say, I want to be plunged into that. That's what I want. That smells true. That's got a ring of authenticity, of real humanness about it. There's nothing animalistic. There's nothing beastie. There's nothing monstrous about that. That's true. I plunge me into that. Baptism. Let's talk about it for a second. Like literally, 10 seconds. It's just an ancient picture. It's a physical picture, an ancient picture of saying, God has already always chosen me. God has already chosen in Jesus to become like me. And now by his grace, I choose him. I choose to become like God. May my life be submerged, plunged into the life of Jesus. I want to be plunged into his death and his defeat of death. That's what I want. And this might be a good moment to say, if you're an adult, if you're a child who wants to be baptized, we can do that. We can do that. That's if you want to follow Jesus in that way, let's have a conversation, because I would let's make that happen. That would be awesome. We're having a child dedication next week, my child. And then sometime soon after that, we can have a baptism. Boom. The point is, with baptism, God doesn't force anybody to be like him. That's not the way God works. He doesn't force anybody on the narrow road of love. But it's the best possible life, and he's always inviting us into it. He's always wanting to gently conquer us with love. I can't always see his kingship. It feels a little strange sometimes. I'm not always even, pastors aren't supposed to say this, I'm not always even certain of it. I'm not always even certain that Jesus is king. Sometimes I'm skeptical of the entire thing, but I'm going to follow him. I'm going to follow him. It's not monstrous. It's the best possible way of life. I love that Matthew ends his gospel this way. He's really honest. We could do with more of this in the church. Because Matthew says that even those who saw it for themselves, even the disciples, even the people who lived through this, even they were skeptical. Even they doubted. Right at the end, they worshiped him, verse 17, but some doubted. It's countless moments like these that convince me beyond anything that the biblical witness is true. It's true. Matthew's finishing his story. Like, he's finished his coffee and he's rolling up his scroll. Good work. I've finished it. I've written it all down. He's talking about the most unbelievable event in human history, the most world-changing event in all of history with a remarkable, like, honesty and a remarkable, like, matter-of-factness about it. There was Jesus. He was back from the dead. The disciples were with him. They recognized that he's God with us. They're worshiping him. And some doubted. Some like, what do we have to do to convince you? Some doubted. We think a lot of times that, like, we are, like, at a huge disadvantage, I think, because, like, the earliest Christians had this gigantic advantage over us, but they didn't. They didn't. They were there. They had seen it. They had lived through all of it. And we think if we had all of those things, we would have stronger faith. If I could just see it and experience it and be through all of it, I would have really strong faith. But Matthew says no. No, 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 no. It's always trust. It always requires faith. It's always a leap. It's always like you're never certain of it. You have to make the leap. They had been there. They'd seen it all. They had lived through it. And they still struggled with it. They still struggled. We aren't told what they doubted. Maybe they doubted, like, their eyes. Maybe they doubted their senses. Am I dreaming all of this? Maybe they doubted their experiences. Maybe they doubted their sanity. I don't know what they doubted. It's the smallest, almost like throwaway of comment that Matthew makes. They doubted. But I find it so encouraging. Maybe I'm the only one, but I find it so encourages. It encourages me that this guy named Matthew doesn't whitewash history. He doesn't like try to pretend. He's just telling us what happened. Just telling us what it's like. I find that encouraging with the Bible, but I find that so encouraging with the life of faith and the life of following Jesus. Slide 5. Because doubts don't exclude us from the life of faith. Doubts don't exclude us from the life of faith. We're not excluded from the presence of Jesus because of doubts. We're not excluded from the people of God, from the community around Jesus, the King's community. We're not excluded because of doubts. If you never doubt on some level, if you never doubt, if you never question, if you never wonder, if you never wrestle, I wonder whether you have any faith at all. I don't think you do. I don't think you have faith at all. You might have some kind of certainty. Some kind of, like, certainty. And that's something we substitute for faith a lot of times. Certainty. A false kind of certainty. We push away every hint of color, and we live in a binary world of black and white. Like, we shove away all mystery, all wonder, and we live in sort of like a self-deceived kind of certainty. But once you've got certainty, you can never have any doubts. The problem is, once you have certainty, you can also never have faith. Once you've got certainty, you can never have any doubts. But once you've got certainty, you can never have any kind of faith. God never, Jesus never, the Spirit never draws us into the life of certainty. Ever. What he draws us into is the life of faith, the life of trust. Doubts are a normal part of the life of faith. They don't exclude us from the life of faith. Following Jesus is not about getting certainty about the things that we want certainty about the very existence of God. We could start there. Or about why God's hiding behind a curtain somewhere. Or about how God created the universe. 7 literal days. Blah, blah, blah. About why God allows suffering. About why that thing happened in my life. About why that thing continues to happen in my life. About how prayer works, about how the Bible works, about how anything works. We don't get certainty about any of this. We don't get certainty about basically anything in life. That's not what we are invited into. We are invited into faith. We're invited into trust. We're invited to make the leap. Make the leap. To see the life of someone, God revealed in a particular person, and say, even if on the days when it feels like I'm talking to an imaginary friend, that guy, that God, I am throwing it all in with him. I'm jumping in with him. Even though I don't understand it all, even though I've still got doubts, I am going to continue to make that leap. And it's not just an intellectual leap. It's not just a leap with our, like, our minds, as if God's just interested in us doing, like, theological Olympics or something like that, or mental intellectual gymnastics or something like that. No, when we're saying that we're throwing ourselves into something, we're making the leap, what we're doing is we're making the leap into a particular kind of life, to a particular way of living. The life where we don't just like play mental gymnastics or something with ideas about God or Jesus or whatever. Nope. What Matthew's been trying to get at the entire gospel is he's inviting us into the life where we actually begin following Jesus. We actually do it. Whatever way we can. Verse 20, Jesus tells his disciples to teach the nations. Disciple the nations. Teach them to obey everything that he taught them. And that begs the question. Before we teach or disciple anybody about anything, are we learning to obey what Jesus taught? Are we learning to make the leap with our lives? Learning to live the life of faith? It's going to be very difficult to teach that to anybody if we're not actually learning to do it. We're invited to do it. To do it. Stop with the... Now is when we're going to do it. We're going to do it. I'm not going to just assume... I'm going to assume for just a moment that talky, teachy Jesus in Matthew doesn't just like hearing himself talk or teach. I'm going to assume just for a moment that he actually is alive and that he actually is holding real and lasting life before me. And I'm going, darn it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to follow Jesus on the narrow road. This might, as an example, this might look like just carving out time in our lives to try praying. It might look like that. Like setting a timer on our phone for 5 minutes. Going to do this for 5 minutes, maybe 2 minutes, if like seriously, maybe just 2 minutes of just trying to sit and be aware of God's love for me, that God is with me until the very end of the age. Maybe I just sit silently for 2 minutes, and then maybe I just tell God, dump on him, tell him what's on my mind, even though I might feel like I'm talking to the ceiling. And then I might finish with the Lord's Prayer. Maybe it looks like that. But darn it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to follow Jesus. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have any kind of certainty about this. I still have doubts. They're still present. But I'm going to make the leap. I'm going to make the leap. I'm going to pray. I'm going to choose to love in my life. I'm going to choose to like move towards forgiveness. Whatever that looks like, having that conversation, meeting with that person, letting that thing go, whatever it is, even when it's hard, even when I don't want to, even with that person. Ah, that person. Gosh. That's what we're invited into. That's what we're invited into. Not just a game in our heads, theological Olympics, intellectual gymnastics. No, just obedience. Just begin walking the road, the narrow road. It's not about certainty. It's not about certainty. It's about making a leap with our lives. And so, may we give up the war for certainty. and trust Jesus even with our doubts. May we ourselves become students of Jesus. And may our lives begin to teach others what it looks like to walk the narrow road of love. And may we see by God's grace, in God's timing, with God's patience, may we see our lives and our families, and this school, this hill, our neighborhoods, may we see them gently conquered by the reign of love.